no enemy stands a chance against our special forces. Not even a chance. They don't have a chance. And that's the way we're going to keep it. And you're going to be better off because you're going to have the finest equipment known to man.
He's got the nuclear codes. He wants to beef up a U.S. military that's already active in most of the world's nations. And President Trump has inherited a tangle of unresolved ethical issues around the use of unmanned killer technology, drones in particular. President Obama, during his tenure, launched 10 times more drone strikes than George W. Bush. Obama's National Intelligence Director, James Clapper, said just before leaving office in January that those 526 drone strikes killed about 3,000 combatants and up to 117 civilians. Some human rights activists say that civilian figure is way low. Of course, any civilian death in military action is a tragedy. Sometimes it's a war crime. Certainly, it's to be avoided if at all possible. But if you compare the 100,000 or so civilians killed in Iraq under President Bush, targeted drone strikes start to look like the lesser evil in taking out terrorists. But drones and killer robots present a particular set of ethical questions. When and how is it justified to use them? What happens if we become the targets? President Obama was said to be methodical in thinking this through. His administration, in its final weeks in office, put out a 61-page playbook of processes and standards for targeted killings, which, come to think of it, sounds kind of creepy. But now, of course, we have a new president, and in his first, second, and third days in office, Donald Trump authorized drone strikes in central Yemen, killing 5 suspected members of al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. So, going forward, how will President Trump use drones and military robotics? How will the world react? Who might retaliate? And how prepared are we all for a world in which machines, increasingly, do the killing? And a whole lot else. This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And in this episode, I'm trying something new. I'm handing the reins over to a guest reporter, Jeb Sharp, a wonderful editor and reporter at The World who has, among other things, been reporting on and thinking about drones for quite some time. I asked her to think about them for Whose Century Is It? And she generously agreed. Over to you, Jeb.
I don't remember exactly when I became obsessed with drones, also known as unmanned aerial vehicles or remotely piloted aircraft, but you couldn't cover U.S. foreign policy after 9/11 without being aware of their use, both for surveillance and in strikes against terrorism suspects. Drone strikes raise tough questions about ethics, about the laws of war, about the efficacy of bombing, and perhaps more than anything, the power of the executive branch. When President Obama came into office, he stepped up the pace of drone strikes considerably. For a while, he was authorizing drone strikes every few days, whereas President George W. Bush had been authorizing one every few weeks. The U.S. was conducting these strikes in countries like Afghanistan, where the U.S. was at war, but also in covert operations in countries like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, where the U.S. was not officially at war. Critics, including counterinsurgency experts, worried that the civilian casualties caused by drone strikes were radicalizing local populations and possibly creating more terrorists than the drone strikes were eliminating. The CIA's role in the strikes was also controversial. Critics worried there wasn't enough legal oversight and that the actions blurred the line between civilians and the military. The Obama administration grappled with these issues for years, eventually moving control of covert drone strikes to the military, but continuing to cloak its targeted killing program in considerable secrecy. Critics, including former Pentagon official Rosa Brooks, struggled with the implications. In her book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, she gives a remarkable account of one drone strike from the perspective of someone inside the bureaucracy in Washington. She told the story again in an interview we did on The World last year.
This was in, I think, late in 2010, and it was before U.S. drone strikes had become a big media issue at all. And they really weren't, I think, registering in a particularly big way, either in the public mind or in my own. And I found myself sitting in this room, one of those Pentagon classified conference rooms with no windows, and you feel like you're in an airlock deeply underwater or something. And we were being shown a set of slides about a young man, the suspected terrorist, and these are amazingly detailed. You know, we had his picture, we had his resume, we had details about his suspected terrorist strikes he'd been involved in. And everybody's kind of sitting there looking serious and looking grave. And the briefers were saying, well, we haven't been able to strike him because he's been in populated areas. But as soon as a window of opportunity opens up, as soon as he's no longer near other people, we're going to strike using an unmanned aerial vehicle to minimize risk to our people. And I sort of sat there thinking, you know, you know, it felt very routine. It's all very bureaucratic. It didn't feel different from any other meeting. And a couple of days later, I was eating dinner with my children, who were, I think, maybe 4 and 7 at the time, eating spaghetti and meatballs. And my cell phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was one of my colleagues. And he had been at that meeting with me. And he said, hey, you know that window of opportunity we were talking about? It just opened up. And I knew immediately what he meant, that the strike that had been planned had actually occurred, and this guy whose picture I'd been looking at and whose resume I'd been looking at was now dead. And I said, okay, thanks for letting me know. We'll talk tomorrow. We obviously couldn't talk any more about it on the phone. And I still didn't think that much of it. You know, I went back to having dinner with my kids, and then that night I had a terrible nightmare. I still scares me to think of it. It was just this awful nightmare of someone I loved murdered and body parts all over. And I kind of woke up shaking, and you know, it sort of hit me only then. Whoa, you know, on some level, I should have known this already. But you go to work at the Pentagon, and whether even if you're not the one who pulls any triggers ever or gives any orders, you know, you're part of a vast bureaucratic enterprise that kills people, that reaches down out of the sky and kills people thousands of miles away.
That's an excerpt of an interview I did with Rosa Brooks last year, and I'll include a link to it in the post for this episode of Whose Century Is It? Because Brooks went on to say some really interesting things that you wouldn't necessarily expect to follow that anecdote. But I include her story here just to remind us how complicated the issues raised by new technologies can be. The drone is just the technology. The moral and legal and military and political issues arise because of the way human beings have chosen to use that technology. Someone who's thought a whole lot about all of this is P.W. Singer, strategist at New America and author of Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century, as well as a novel about these issues called Ghost Fleet. So I called him for an update. We spoke about drones, but also robotics more generally and the issues and challenges they raise for society at large.
So, Peter, last time we spoke was 2010, and I know you were way ahead of the rest of us anyway, but I remember you saying that something that had been viewed as abnormal, as science fiction, was now the new normal of war. And you said something else that really stuck with me, which was that all the R&D underway at U.S. aerospace companies, even back then, had switched to unmanned aircraft. So the future was drones. And I wonder now, in 2017, has that trajectory continued apace? Is the sky full of drones? Were you right?
We've definitely seen all sorts of mores in how you might think of this space. So in terms of use, you know, let's pull back on this. Our forces went into Afghanistan after 9/11. They had a handful of unmanned aerial systems, remotely piloted aircraft, drones, whatever you want to call them. None of them were armed. Today, we have over 10,000 in the inventory. On the ground, they had zero unmanned ground systems, ground robotics. Today, there's more than 12,000. It's not just more in terms of our numbers. It's more in terms of other places' numbers. 86 different countries have military robotics today. It's not just in terms of countries. It's non-state actors. That's been one of the things that's really taken off in the last couple of years. And they range. They're non-state actors that, you know, most people would think are the good guys. For example, environmental groups using drones to track down poachers and everywhere from Africa to illegal whale hunters off the Antarctic to groups that we would all pretty much agree are bad guys. ISIS, for example, in just the last 2 months has conducted 60 different drone operations just around the Battle of Mosul, one third of them armed.
What kind of drones?
So in this case, they're using commercial ones, many of the same kind that we have. They've basically have been taking the kind of quadcopter style that you and I can buy. There have also been some kits that they've made themselves. There was a drone factory, so to speak, that was taken out by Kurdish forces recently. So they're not of the same level of sophistication as the ones that the U.S. military has right now. But again, pull back on this. They're much better than ones that militaries had 15 years ago, or those few militaries that had them. So there's all of this growth in terms of the user base. It's also another big more is their diversity of form, their design. So again, even that illustration, you know, we've gone from the drones looking like the manned airplanes they were replacing, and even like the cockpits being painted over, to ones that are quadcopters, forms that you hadn't seen man machines having, to there's ones that are taking inspiration from nature. So someone, we can't say who, but someone lost in Pakistan and in another operation in East Africa, a robotic plane that looked exactly like a bird. I can't conceive of why anyone would want a drone to look like something from nature. Hint, hint.
Why not?
It allows you to infiltrate and avoid detection in ways that might be obvious when it's a plane. Also, just to be in a different way, there's lots of different design inspiration that's being taken from nature because, frankly, nature has billions of years of evolution behind it to help with design. The big more shift is in their intelligence and their autonomy. So these systems have gone from being almost completely remotely operated. There's not a pilot physically inside it, but there's a pilot somewhere controlling a joystick, you know, controlling each of its moves, to where we've moved to is instead the systems being able to do more and more on their own, whether it's a system like the Global Hawk, where basically, it's not a joystick, but it's a keyboard, and it flies mission waypoints. To a better example might be the U-Class program. Any Navy pilot will happily tell you that to take off and land from an aircraft carrier is one of the toughest human pilot tasks of all. And we've already seen in the U-Class program a autonomous jet do that on its own, take off and land from an aircraft carrier, and importantly, do it again and again and again and again perfectly.
Wow.
And that's, wow. And that same type of story has shifted over to our civilian world, where we've seen, for example, driverless cars, be they, the Google car to Budweiser showed off an 18-wheeler delivering beer driving down the highway. And in the commercial for it, the driver is in the front seat as it goes down the highway. He punches a big prominent red button and then gets up and walks to the back of the 18-wheeler, and the 18-wheeler drives itself down the highway. The point is that these mores are everything from more robotic systems, more users, more intelligent, more forms, and taking on more tasks.
And I think it depends who you are, or I think who you are determines which piece of this you get obsessed with. You know, I work in the news business and we cover wars, and a lot of us came to drones through learning about targeted killings in Afghanistan, in war zones, but also in places like Somalia and Yemen, where there were covert wars going on, and there were really heartfelt controversies about the ethics, the legality, the efficacy of, you know, using these remotely piloted aircraft to carry out these attacks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those controversies and debates still go on, right? But at the time when we became seized with them, part of the issue was that the technology was far outpacing our ability to create ethical systems to cope with it. And from what you say, I would imagine that's only gotten worse. just the pace, the volume, the multiplication.
Yeah, I think you're right in a number of different ways. So there's everything from the story of how the technology, the unmanned aerial system, the drone, became wrapped up within a certain way that it's used, drone strikes, even though they're used in lots of other different ways. And even, you know, even if you're looking at using it to carry out strikes, people are mainly using that as a way to talk about strikes into places like a Pakistan or a Somalia, where we're not formally in any kind of discussion at war. We don't have large numbers of boots on the ground or the like. So drone strikes are controversial relative to a Pakistan, or at least they used to be, but not controversial if you're talking about just across the border in Afghanistan, where they're in support of NATO forces. And I think what it's getting at is, for people, it's less so the fact that it's a drone than what it's enabled, you know, an intelligence agency operating in a somewhat covert manner. The rules of engagement are very different than when it's U.S. military informally in support overtly of U.S. forces on the ground. But even that story of controversy has changed. So I found it pretty notable that when the Trump administration carried out its first drone strike, it wasn't seen as notable. It wasn't reported widely as a big deal, as, for example, compared to when the SEAL team operation in Yemen played out. So the point is that even things that were once controversial maybe aren't being handled in the same way. But broader from that is just the fact that, as you laid out, the technology continues to move ahead, and our politics, our policies, our laws, they have a hard time keeping a pace with it. I like to describe it this way, that technology moves at an exponential pace. It's always sort of doubling upon itself, whereas our laws move at a glacial pace, if that. And so the disconnect becomes wider and wider. And again, you can see this in these discussions of how is it affecting war, but it's the same thing if you talk about robotic vehicles on our roads. Or a different example that recently played out would be in policing. There were obvious controversies that still have not been resolved of how law enforcement can or should use unmanned systems, drones, for surveillance, under what circumstances, who controls them, what does it mean for search warrants, all these different things. And then last summer, we had this episode where the Dallas Police Department used a robot that had been originally designed for bomb disposal and said they jury-rigged it with a bomb and used it to blow up a sniper. And so we had an ad hoc weaponized robotic system used in a lethal manner inside the United States. And notice I didn't say yay or boo on it. I just said this is something new. And this question that hadn't been figured out of everything from, you know, who should be able to operate armed ground robotic systems, if they should be allowed to operate them, what are the rules, what are the training regimens for SWAT teams that are deployed with them or not, who validates these rules, all these different sort of, you know, basic questions that we would have with any sorts of new technology, we hadn't figured it out. And now we have to, because that line's already been crossed. And, you know, my personal take on it is that I'm not comfortable seeing each and every little local police department figure this out on their own, because just like we see in other issues of policing, some departments are going to handle it really well, really professionally, have the resources to wrestle with these questions. And frankly, other departments aren't and don't have a great track record at it. So another way of putting it is, I don't want to see a Ferguson Police Department be on its own trying to figure out how to use armed robots or not.
Right. If we pull back to the international scene, and even through the lens of a transition to a new administration here and a pretty chaotic, dramatic start, what are the implications?
Those are some decent adjectives. I've got a lot more.
I suspect you do. You're there in the belly of the Washington beast. What are the implications? And let's just, for the sake of thinking about this, think about the drones that are in the skies. What are the implications globally in terms of international security of this proliferation?
There's a number of aspects that are playing out. One is the proliferation of the technology itself, and it's giving all sorts of different actors capabilities that they didn't have before. An ISIS using drones for everything from surveillance to aid it in the targeting of its weapons and its offenses. And when I say aid in the targeting, like literally able to pinpoint which building its weapons are aiming at, to it's also using it to collect video that then it posts up on social media that it's using for recruiting and propaganda, to using it to carry out airstrikes. They've, as I mentioned before, just in the Battle of Mosul, we've seen more than 60 of these missions, and we've seen a number of Iraqi forces as well as allied forces killed or injured. So this capability, a rebel group, a terrorist group operating a little miniature air force, that's not something we saw before. Now, is it the same thing as having the U.S. Air Force on your side? Of course not. It's not, you know, changing the overall massive national balance of power, but it's giving capabilities that weren't there before, that are proliferating outward. In so doing, it creates dilemmas for everything from, hold it, we have forces on the ground that didn't used to have to think about how do I do air defense against, you know, this rebel group, and they have to now. And so we've had this sort of quick trying to push out air defense weapons against drones to our forces in Iraq. And some of these are some really quite novel new systems. You know, for example, ones that try to go after the very fact that it is a drone. They go after the electronics of it and try and jam the communication, take away its GPS, you know, a whole different approach to air defense. There's a different story here when you talk about it in the hands of states and how they might act or interact. One of the things that we've seen, for example, is there's a lot of tension in both in the Persian Gulf and now in the South China Sea. And we've introduced robotics into it, but it's unclear as of yet sort of how different nations will look at these systems. So, for example, in the past, in operations in the Persian Gulf, the United States has warned Iran that if you shoot at our unmanned systems, we'll consider this the same as you going after our other national assets. And, you know, that's a powerful statement. In turn, in the South China Sea, we saw this episode where essentially we lost, I put that in quotation marks, but to put it better, China kidnapped one of our robotic subs. This was very soon after Trump had made some pretty inflammatory statements. And a lot of people read it as China trying to sort of push back and show, you know, hey, you can't bully us around and this, we're going to do other things in different areas. But the point is that kind of episode, how do you react to it? Or a different one would be both China and Japan are now jousting in air operations, including with their unmanned systems that they're flying back and forth. What happens when one of these things crashes, or what happens when one of these things accidentally bumps into a manned machine? What I'm getting at is you have this whole kind of new dynamic that's tossed into it. I've got my own opinions on how the different laws of war apply or how you should react, but the point is not everyone shares these understandings, and so it's a complicating factor.
And I think for lay people trying to even lay people who are determined citizens who would like to be thinking about these things, this stuff is really invisible and hard to picture, and therefore hard to think about what to do with.
Well, I think part of it is our just too often disconnection from what's happening in a foreign policy, what's happening in national security. We tune in infrequently and often in a partisan lens, and we're not well served by that. And then we often, you know, find ourselves as a nation in a situation where you kind of pull back and go, how did we get here? A second challenge when you're talking about this technology in particular is the science fiction aspect of it. It's so wrapped up in our perceptions of science fiction that it's when we do try and wrap our heads around it, it's often through that lens. And sometimes we, you know, give capabilities that are not yet there. We, you know, so we're talking about systems that aren't yet the Terminator, and yet it's often how it's framed in terms of some sort of autonomous systems and the like. But the other part of this is I'm going to push back and say we will become more and more linked up, more and more. This will be more and more in your face, whatever role you play in life. And we can see this in everything from the manufacturing. And there's, you know, obviously one of the key things that played out in the 2016 election was upset about what we've seen in job displacement and manufacturing, and, you know, we're going to bring those jobs back. Well, 87% of the jobs were taken not by foreigners, but were taken by machines, by automation. And guess what? Technology ain't given those jobs back. And so we already saw that dynamic sort of creating that anger, but somewhat misplaced, play out. It's going to continue your interaction with a service like an Uber or an Amazon is going to become one that more and more links up to robotic systems, as we see everything from automated cars. Uber's already rolling this out in, for example, in Pittsburgh. You know, we're not saying off in the year 2050. We're saying now to Amazon and you and many other companies looking to deliver things with robotic systems. So the point is it may seem off in the distance or not affecting you, but it will, if it hasn't yet already.
Is there anything striking with the new administration that affects how policy goes forward on any of the ones that are in the public imagination? I mean, if we just take drone strikes or we just look at automation in industry, I mean, are you, as someone who watches Washington, seeing anything stark that has happened with the transition that affects this arena?
We haven't yet seen much in the particulars, and obviously a lot of different policy areas, but particularly in these areas. So more you have to rely on sort of overall tone and overall areas of emphasis or de-emphasis. And as when you think about this space, a couple aspects or seem to be, it will play out. So one is a general suspicion of global alliances and global norms. So in the past, you might have seen a push to, so for example, the Obama administration, it was clearly active with drones. One thing you cannot accuse it of is not conducting drone strikes. But one of the things that they, at least in their discourse, tried to lay out was, okay, we need to create a set of norms and rules for how these strikes are authorized within our system, and then can we influence that in international norms? Now, people can have an argument back and forth on how effective that was, but it was very clear that was one of the things that they emphasized. I am dubious that that's going to be something that we'll see in the Trump administration, just because of its general attitude towards international law, international norm building, trying to be a leader and the like. It's been a more, you know, sort of inward look so far. Another part that I think we can deduce would have been evident by President Trump's, you know, different sort of tweet announcements on saving a couple hundred jobs here and there, that ignores a bigger shift that's going on in the economy. So you could have been approaching this saying, look, the economy itself is changing. Technology is changing. And we have to set up America's economy for this present and this future. These jobs are, it's not someone took them, it's the technology took them. And how do we retool ourselves for that? How do we better prepare for that so that we're not leaving not just this one individual factory, but entire sectors, entire states behind? Instead, it's, you know, been these sort of tweet outs of, you know, claiming of saving jobs, which in most cases, they're actually decisions that the company's already made before. They've figured out how to game this. And then the third area is a general attitude toward science and research and development that leaves me concerned. Science, research, and development, these are the jewels of the crown. These are the key assets in why America is ahead in everything from our technology to our national security to what it means for our economy. And when you threaten those, either by defunding programs or restricting access to data or kicking out or keeping out scientists, you jeopardize this jewel in the crown, this thing that's been so important to America. So a different way of putting it is, if we're seeing a revolution in technology and in business and war, the worst thing that you can do is try and take away the assets that will allow you to succeed in that revolution.
Is there any question at this point that another nation is overtaking us?
We're talking about a broad area, so you can find certain programs where we are well ahead, and we darn well should be well ahead, for example, in certain aspects of military robotics, because we've been doing it the longest, and we have by far the largest defense budget. That doesn't mean, however, that we aren't seeing other nations catch up. In particular, China is one when you talk about military robotics, but other aspects of robotics as well, but particularly military robotics, they're doing a massive amount of investment, and they've been showing off new programs and everything from stealthy drones to ground robotic systems and the like. So then there's other areas of business where maybe we aren't ahead. And that applies to, if you're looking at, for example, some of the exciting things going on in programs in Japan or programs in Europe. So, you know, you can't make a blanket statement about the technology overall. Instead, you kind of have to break it down into different programs in different areas. But the point is this is a, if you're thinking about it as a race, if you slow down to a walk and the other guy is running, even if they're behind you, at some point they'll catch up and pass you. So if we if we're making decisions now that are, to continue that image, shooting ourselves in the foot, then we're clearly not going to be in a great position in the future.
And Peter, how is this technology changing human beings?
Human beings are the same as they've always been. We're motivated, by our passions, by our emotions, by our intellect, all these different things crossing together. So I don't think the technology is changing us as humans. It's changing the world around us, the options that we have, the possibilities, the perils that we face. So it's, you know, when you think about robotic systems, you're talking about a technology that's equivalent to the advent of the steam engine, the advent of atomic energy, the atomic bomb, but maybe even one day past that, because you're talking about not just merely a tool that we can use, but as the technology becomes more and more advanced, more and more intelligent, more and more autonomous, it's not just merely a tool. It can truly take on human-like tasks. That doesn't change the humans, but it changes the world that we face, both the possibilities that we have and the perils that are out there that we have to solve.
Thank you so much for thinking out loud about this.
Thanks for having me.
Peter W. Singer is the author of Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war, and Wired for War, the Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. He thinks and strategizes about these things at New America. And I'm Jeb Sharp, editor and correspondent at PRI's The World. I don't know about you, but my head is spinning. Sometimes I wonder if there will be anywhere left to run to escape all the devices, airborne and otherwise. They continue to fascinate me nevertheless. I will post links to some great new books about drones at the webpage for Whose Century Is It? Thanks so much for listening, and as always, let us know what you think. Back to you, Mary Kay.
Thanks, Jeb. Lots to think about indeed. That China's working hard to catch up with the United States on military robotics and stealth drones. The question of what happens when different countries' drones clash. And Peter Singer's warning that America squanders its crown jewels of science, research, and development at its peril. But this isn't just about America. Drones, robotics, and other automation will increasingly be used around the world, in peace and in warfare. You might want to check out a recent foreign policy article on some of these issues by Mika Zenko, a senior fellow with the Center for Preventative Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. Late in 2016, he convened a group of 20 experts to discuss some of the issues surrounding drone strikes, and he writes about what they agreed, including that, to quote him, the domestic legal underpinning for targeted strikes, the 2001 authorization for use of military force, has been stretched beyond the point of being credible. Huge thanks to Jeb Sharp for her thoughtful questioning and shaping of the interview with Peter Singer, and thanks to him too, of course. And Jeb might be the first guest reporter on my podcast, but she won't be the last. I'll be bringing in more of my colleagues from the world in upcoming episodes. So, as ever, keep listening. You can get us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or your other podcast app of choice, or stream us on pri.org/century, where you'll also find essays, photos, and links for all of our episodes. If you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes or your other podcast app. It helps others find it. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. See you next time.